You're listening to the Styling Advisory Podcast, the only show exploring the business of personal styling and how stylists are helping retailers to personalize customer experiences. We're interested in how styling leaders have built a successful business and what retailers are doing to capitalize on the styling client community. If you're a personal stylist currently avoiding doing the marketing activity on your to-do list today, schedule your tea and chat with founder and host Sarah Cohen via the website. Okay, now.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm getting there. I feel like there's, you know, like light again, you know?
And for everyone listening, this is because you have been through the entire process of startup to investment to selling a business to now starting up again. So you were saying the other day that you felt like you were down the bottom again, you know.
Totally.
Moving up again. So let me introduce you properly. And I'm going to read through this because even though I've known you since school, you know, I don't want to downplay your achievements. So best that I read them out. So Rebecca Lau Marsh, nay Rebecca Lau, is a stylist and entrepreneur. Now, you created two disruptive businesses in the e-commerce and fashion industries, which I'm going to get you to talk about, Bosch Celebrity Fashion and White Runway. And as I said before, you're one of the rare entrepreneurs that's been able to experience not only the startup phase, but its ultimate sort of the ability to sell that business and then move on to the next project. So let's start, for everyone that's listening, give us a sort of a bit brief background on the first two businesses to where you are now.
Okay, cool. So I started my first online commerce store, which is what you talked about, Gosh, back in 2007. And so when I started, I actually came back from the UK. I was in a sales job and I used to hit my targets and be like twiddling my thumbs thinking, what the hell do I do? Sit at my desk and do some online shopping, as you do. And then I came back to Australia and there was just nothing out there. And so that's when I thought, you know, I'd come up with Gosh. I loved, you know, magazines and seeing, you know, what Misha Barton wore and then, you know, how to sort of recreate that look. And I thought I should do that, but also sell it. I was really good at sort of styling outfits for girlfriends and all that sort of stuff. And so it was pretty much just doing the same old thing, but doing it on a website. Mm-hmm. And making it easy for people to be able to purchase those items that you sort of see in a collage in a magazine. And so Gosh sort of took off. It was such a new concept. It was allowing everyday Australians to be able to look $1 million without paying, you know, that amount. And so that did really well for me. And then I saw a bit of a gap in the market for evening wear. And that's because I started sort of, you know, as you do, trial and error. And I noticed that a lot of people were purchasing evening gowns. And I thought, this is great. So I contacted a couple of customers and sort of said, oh, you've just purchased, you know, three or four of the same gown in different sizes. And they sort of said, yeah, you know, we've been looking for bridesmaids dresses, which don't cost a bomb, that look great, they're modern. And so I really researched and I thought, you know what, bridesmaid fashion has not changed in the last however many decades. It was all that sort of strapless chiffon satiny type of thing. And that's why I thought, you know, there's a real opportunity here to sort of disrupt the market, come out with bridesmaid dresses that have an accessible price point, that's not a complete waste of money, that you'd be able to wear again, and you actually look great while you're wearing them. I was a bridesmaid for a friend and I was in this strapless chiffon lilac, you know, little number, and I thought, oh my God, I would not be seen dead wearing this anywhere, but here I am with 400 people, you know, MC for my best friend's wedding, you know? So yeah, so that's White Runway.
A couple of things that I think are really important for everyone listening to understand. Number one, Gosh Celebrity Fashion, 2007 in Australia in the fashion industry, this was a huge innovation because it really was the birth of that fast fashion online e-com space. So the fact that you were at the forefront of that is amazing. Then when you sort of sidestepped into White Runway and you sort of carved out a new niche, not only were you modernizing that niche, that segment, but I remember chatting to you at the time and you were like, oh babes, I'm just going to introduce this thing where you can change the length or the size or the color or whatever, which was ultimately the birth of customization and personalization, which every single marketing conference in the world talks about how brands are always looking for ways to customize and personalize. But you were again at the forefront of that, including your size range. So let's just say more words about that.
Right. So we were the first ones, I think, to make it accessible for people to be able to customize certain parts of their dress without having to pay for a seamstress to come in and redesign the whole thing. We offered sizes, you know, 4 through to 24, because come on, like, you know, majority of sizes that you buy off the rack are only your 6 to 18, and then the fits are usually modeled on a size 8, you know, 6 foot model. And so that didn't really make sense for that white runway customer. And so we had them, we had additional customizations that they could make to the dress. We'd have your standard sort of dress, but then if you were extra tall, you could add length. If you wanted to cover your arms, you could add sleeves. So we really worked with our designers to sort of say, hold on, you know, we are off the rack, but we want to be able to make some adjustments. And the wedding industry being, you know, usually they're waiting for 3 to 6 months for their product or orders and all that sort of stuff. The customer is attuned to sort of waiting that time. So that allowed us to provide them with those customizations and make it feasible for us commercially as well.
And so you sold that business, didn't you, in what, 2015, was it?
Yeah, 2015. So we were predominantly online, and then after speaking to our customers, and there's this constant communication with the customer and trying to understand what works best for them. And you've sort of also got to filter that noise. I think it's really, really important to speak to customers, but everyone you speak to has a slightly different opinion and you can't listen to everyone. But you sort of filter through and you sort of think, okay, this makes sense. I understand that. And so originally being online, we then built showrooms. So we had one in Sydney, one in Melbourne, and then eventually Brisbane and then New York. And that really allowed us to welcome that customer into our rooms and also let us learn from the customer and also train our stylists in-house on how to address certain body shapes.
Yes, and that's a huge thing. I think one of the great things about you providing the extensive size range is a bridal party has got to be one of the most common cross-sections of the market, where you get people of all shapes and sizes and you all want us to wear a bloody lilac chiffon dress. It's just not going to work. So I remember for you guys having that opportunity to either have a style or a colorway that could be modified to suit everyone was great. And for the stylists that were in your showrooms providing that styling service, do you think the customization was a major draw card for these bridal parties that would come in and with everyone their own sort of host of body issues and confidence?
I think there were two things. Number one, when we looked at ordering, when we sort of curated the range of dresses that we offered, we always made sure that the dresses were flattering, had a flattering fit regardless of what sort of size range they were. You know, there were some absolute styles that we did not stock, which is, you know, your satin strapless type of A-line frock that didn't really look good on some body shapes. But as a general rule, we sort of, whenever we bring in dresses or curate dresses for the collection that we sell, we ensure that we have the size range and that they're going to be flattering in those styles. And then two, yes, the stylists came through and they would be able to offer those customers who wanted, say, for example, to cover up their arms. You know, sometimes they love the dress on their figure, but they just didn't like it because it showed too much arm. Or then we had, you know, customers who might have been a religious, they might have been Muslim or any other religion, which required them to have long sleeves. And so we didn't want to say sort of, oh, sorry, you know, go get your own matching item to go with the dress. We wanted to offer that customization in the same fabric. But that really opened up the opportunities for all different types of women, shapes, sizes, race, colour, you know, religion, to be able to look great in our dresses.
And I think the reason why I wanted to chat with you, aside from obviously just loving chatting with you, is I know, having watched from the sidelines, you building these two businesses and now the three new businesses that you're running, Love My Baby, which is Australian-made baby gift boxes, 21 Scrubs, which is fashionable medical scrubs, and Kitten Cradle, which is Australian-made 100% organic cotton baby wear, and you've got children. Jesus Christ, I don't know how you're doing it, but my point is this. Yeah. I also know that you have started all of this without wealthy family, without investors, without capital, and you've had to build everything from the grassroots ground up. You've had to be scrappy and you've had to hustle. So what I thought we'd do today is kind of drill down into the PR side of things. How you were able to make these fashion businesses a success is, I guess, one of the ingredients is getting PR coverage. And I know that you didn't start out as a stylist, but it seems that by pitching yourself as a stylist when you were trying to get PR coverage, it ended up working for you. So we just want to hear all of your insights and maybe learn a couple of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, we used to work together in the past, Sarah, when you were doing PR, and that
we
and
did. What I was going to say,
and that really helped me out a lot. I think throughout the years of, you know, working in fashion and e-com, PR is super important for the brand. Otherwise, you know, you're paying thousands of dollars to try and get placements or advertising and so forth. For the businesses that I've had and do have, I'm constantly thinking of new angles to be able to pitch. Some of the things that I do is you know, I'll get into, obviously you're not in that pitch frame of mind all the time, but there are certain times in the year that I sit down and I sort of go, okay, we need to make something newsworthy. How can we get out there? And so most recently with the 21 Scrubs, which is the medical, stylish medical apparel range, I put my PR hat on and thought, okay, what would be interesting for journalists to write about? And so I started looking up journalists and started reading the stories that they wrote. And then I sort of had a look at what was going on recently in the world. And we just had Australian Fashion Week. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, this is a good time. I obviously don't want to hit them up leading up to Fashion Week, and I don't want to hit them up during Fashion Week because they've got plenty of stories to write about then. So I'll wait till the week after Fashion Week where they're sort of chilled out and then looking for new stories to write. And then I started getting inspired by a lot of the stories that they wrote and thought, how can I spin this so that I can give them a similar angle? Mm-hmm. I came across a story where it's actually one of my friends where he used to work in military, and he has started working in women's fashion, and he sort of made the change from military to runway. Mm-hmm. He recently debuted at Australian Fashion Week. And I thought, okay, well, that's a really interesting angle. Obviously, editors do like this. And that's when I sat down and thought, okay, well, I came from, you know, styling or sending dresses over to Eva Longoria, Jeannie Mai, Erin Holland, Sophie Monk, and all these ladies. And now here I am sort of styling surgeons and vets and so forth. It's pretty comical. Yeah. And so then I thought of the headline, you know, from fashion frocks to surgical scrubs, or, you know, a move from red carpet to fashion in the operating theatre. So trying to think of those fun headlines.
My favourite, what's your headline? The other one I read was something, something, but make it fashion.
Surgery, but make it fashion. I love it so much.
And, you know, this is, guys, this is something I want you all to understand. Beck, you've sold businesses, you've had showrooms in New York, like, we're not mucking around here. You've had incredible business success, and yet it's still you banging away at the computer creating this stuff. The article I read recently in the Daily Mail about 21 Scrubs, and I said to you, what a great article, and you wrote, well, I fucking wrote the whole thing. And that's the important thing to remember, that, you know, that sort of taking charge, making the job as easy as possible for the journalist, and writing as if the article is already written, I think is a really important point, right?
Absolutely. It's making it as easy. I mean, I wrote the basis of it, but then obviously the editor does her magic and she makes it all beautiful and easy to read, because obviously I'm not a journalist, I'm not a great writer, but I'll try really hard. And so it's about making it really easy for someone to pick up your article and be able to read through it very easily and sort of edit where necessary and pop it out there. I mean, these guys are super busy. They've got deadlines to run. They're constantly getting emails. They're constantly getting pictures. And so to make it as easy as possible for them by, you know, creating a couple of fun headlines that are relevant to the stories that they're writing, which are relevant to the current environment, and sort of making it really easy for them to go, okay, yep, great, copy and paste, edit bits and pieces, add a couple of images, and here we go.
Because for a lot of personal stylists that want to build their brand awareness and their audience, their reach, they understand the benefit of contributing to online publications. Print, if it still exists, you know, would be great, but essentially online publications. And so I think the natural approach normally is to go, okay, what's happening at the moment? It's a change of season. So maybe I'll pitch that I can, you know, do a trend report, which... Mm. I'd imagine every stylist in the free world is also thinking the same thing. So our advice would be to flavor that up with relevance, with, I guess, what?
Absolutely.
So what do you reckon? Yep.
Absolutely. So say, for example, what's happening right now? What's in the news? What's been in Johnny Depp, Amber Heard, Okay, so it could be, I mean, we're not seeing a lot of her fashion. She's quite boring, actually, when she goes to court. But it could be things like, you know, get the jailbird, or, you know, how to look innocent, or, you know, the whole inventing Anna, you know, they're going to court and having this particular look about them. Oh, it could be a whole styling session on that.
That is piss funny. How to get
out of jail outfit.
Courtroom couture.
Courtroom couture. I love that. You know, it could be about that because everyone's obsessed with Amber Heard and Johnny Depp and what's happening right now with their court case. Yes. It could be, yes. So anything that's sort of relevant. And if I think back to, okay, what else is news right now?
That's not sad.
That's not sad. That's not to do with bloody politics.
I was just going
to
say an election, war. COVID. Do you know what? Something that I think is always relevant because it's my passion is the current state of retail. What's happening in the retail landscape?
Absolutely, live
shopping, massive one. TikTok.
And I was just talking to a friend this morning about fast fashion because we just found out one of the fast fashion stores has gone into liquidation. I think it's Misguided. So Misguided has gone into administration. And so we were like, wow, in shock. But at the same time, I also felt like fast fashion was eventually sort of going to slow down and come to an end. I think the majority of consumers now are very conscious about the environment and the impact that we can make in the world. And fast fashion creates so much junk and so much pollution, so much goes to landfill. And so I think there is this move towards
sustainable fashion.
Exactly. And this is why I'm doing the baby range, which is organic cotton and sustainable and so forth. But yes, I think with what's going on at the moment, you know, if we're talking about fast fashion and Misguided made headlines, you know, today about it going into administration, you could then pitch sustainable and eco-friendly clothing options, you know, or tweaking that, being able to bring current relevant news items into your pitch would make it so much easier for I think journalists to pick up.
I completely agree. Now, tell me about TV pitching because we can argue the benefits of TV versus online, you know, the return on investment, but I know that you used to do a lot and you still do a lot of TV appearances. Producers are always being pitched segments. Any tips for pitching yourself again, but from a TV perspective?
Yeah, from a TV perspective, they sort of need a little bit more beef for their stories. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, there needs to be a bit more depth. It needs to be sort of like a little production in a way if you were to be able to get yourself online, I mean, on TV. And I used to be able to do things like talk about the latest fashion or what celebrities are wearing and so forth. There's less of an interest in that now. It's more about, you know, the last – one of the episodes that I did with the morning show was about, this is a while ago, the rise of the online bride, you know, and how easy it was for people to be able to swipe left and right to meet their partner, and then how easy it is to be able to get online and purchase your dress and your bridesmaids' dresses and order everything basically for the wedding. Mm-hmm. And so you just need to rock up. And then, you know, brought in some examples or clients who could be my example of the online bride, and you know, they discussed everything that they did online and the advantages and disadvantages and so forth. And again, it's sort of like putting on that producer's hat, just as you'd put on a journalist's hat. Yeah. Put on that producer's hat and sort of think, okay, how do I make this story
a big segment? So you're essentially you're creating your own segment, and for the purposes of comedy, are you reenacting that segment and recording it and sending almost like an audition segment?
Not so much. It's still a pitch via you know, email usually.
I just want to clarify. I obviously know the answer to that question. I just thought it would be as funny as an.
To be honest, action. I think that would be so much fun.
Hello. Exactly. I'm just always thinking of what's going to make me laugh.
And that might be the way to cut through these days. I mean, how boring if you're constantly just getting emails and having to trawl through them. If you just got like this video that popped up, even if it was like a 3-second GIF or something of yourself doing something funny, and then with sort of text around it, it could work.
Exactly. But I guess the big piece of information here is that when you're pitching to TV, which, and I know a lot of my clients or and clients I've worked with in the past, will say to me, I want to get on TV. I want to pitch, you know, that I sort of talk about X, Y, Z. This missing piece of the puzzle that you're saying is you've actually got to flesh that out. So it's not just I'm going to offer my opinion. It's this is the concept for the segment with a beginning, middle, and an end, or an arc. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you're bringing in supporting cast, like as you said, you know, people like your pretend girlfriend. Your girlfriend, exactly. Mm-hmm. But you're actually fleshing out a little tableau, a little segment, a little scene, like you would be producing your own TV show.
Yeah. And I think it would be really handy if you sort of pick a niche to be sort of an expert in. Mm. So if you're a stylist, obviously you can style, you know, numerous body shapes, people and so forth. But if you picked a niche, for example, styling curvy women, or a niche, you know, the best denim sort of expert stylist, a niche where it's, you know, I think it would sort of make you stand out from the crowd if you had a particular niche. And when a relevant story came along, they would think of that person straight away.
Speaking of niches, sustainability is obviously coming more and more to the forefront. It's impacting the retail industry. So for stylists that over the last few years have referred to themselves as a sustainability stylist, or a stylist that's interested in conscious fashion, and I think that there's now a need to diversify or to sort of specialize even more as that word becomes, you know, it's a little bit like how people all call themselves a keynote speaker, you know, these days. Like if everyone's a bloody keynote speaker, then who the fuck are the, who is starting? Do you know what I mean? It makes no sense. If we're all saying keynote speaker, if we're all saying sustainable, if we're all saying personal stylist, how do you stand out? So would you recommend even niching down within the, let's say, that sustainability angle?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in the sustainability angle, it could be new clothes. You know, you're the expert in finding brands that specialize in sustainable clothing. You could be an upcycle stylist where you go into people's houses and then you redo and help them restyle their outfits and bring new life to them, you know. So I think definitely sort of honing in on a niche and being able to shout about your niche is the best way that you're going to be able to get any press or PR about you.
And just sort of extending that brainstorm even further, maybe once you've worked out your niche, let's say you're going to be the upcycling expert, then fleshing out a little mini TV segment, which presents a problem and a solution, is really not only a fantastic exercise because it will help you get that PR coverage, but it keeps you in that marketing mindset of this is what I specialize in. This is why people should work with me. And it keeps you on message, I think. Don't you reckon?
Yeah,
otherwise,
absolutely.
We sort of fall into a more generalized space where we're just rehashing the same sort of sentiments.
And it's so easy these days to create those sort of reels and videos. You can be your own video editor with your phone. So there's no reason why you shouldn't be recording as much content as possible and using that content to do your advertising and so forth. You know, your customers who are looking to sort of upcycle really want to be able to see why you're better than anyone else. And if you're the stylist who's got that content and you're doing the before and afters and you've got all of that, then you build that trust. And you build the confidence that the customer will have in you, and they're intrigued and they want to see what you can do with their wardrobe. So I definitely think, you know, being a stylist, I mean, it's super busy being your own business owner. You're wearing so many hats and you've got so many things to do. It's kind of like, where do you start? You're creating content, you're trying to pitch yourself, you're doing day to day, then you're meeting up with clients. So I think for me, what's been really good, obviously, is setting out your calendar and having your social calendars. So it might be every 3 months that you put on your PR hat or your content hat, and you start really spending sort of a week every 3 months thinking about new angles, and then having the next 3 months to sort of work on them, pitch them and so forth, and then come back to a fresh one every 3 months. That's been really good for me, you know, to have that constant reminder to, oh, hold on, I need to think of an angle. Oh, hold on, we need some PR here or there.
So speaking of cycles and timelines then, if you've sent a pitch and you don't get anything back from it, what did you normally do? Did you wait a few weeks and then touch base again? Did you feel awkward? How did you manage that process? Because I'm hoping that we don't just give up.
No, we don't give up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Usually I wait a week and a half, give them time to digest the information, and then I just send a really quick follow-up and say, hey, just wanted to see whether you were interested in running this particular story, and I put the headline. I might tweak the headline a little bit because that might be you know, that might be favored more than the one I originally sent. And then I said, if you're not interested in this particular story, we'd love to know what you're currently working on, or would love to be added to your call list in the future. And they could easily come back and say, sorry, not what I'm working on right now, but we'll add you to the call list. And great, then hopefully they'll be in contact with you later on. But at least you've had that conversation. Mm. I think, but definitely not be annoying and, you know, email every week or so, because then you'll be blocked. But definitely a nice, you know, how are you going? Just making sure that you received the press release. You can also add, you know, a mail reader, you know, those email readers that you can tag along on your Gmail, so that you know that it's actually reached that person and they've actually read it, and you can tell what time they read it and when they read it and how many times they opened your email. It's a bit stalkerish, but those sort of things help when you want to know to make sure that it hasn't gone to junk mail, because often it can go directly into junk mail. Yeah, having things like that sort of help you and kind of go, okay, well, she read my email 2 days ago. I might make contact today and sort of see where we're at. But I definitely think follow up and building up that relationship is really important.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Starting as we all did at the very beginning, when you start in PR or media and building relationships, you know, back in the good old days of the old corporate lunch, you know, yeah, where you'd be just taking people for lunches, you're building up that sort of friendship, and then you're learning more about them, and then you go in for the pitch. Helps. And I think that's probably an element that we forget, that these people that are being bombarded from every PR agency and every brand around the world ultimately go back to the people they trust and that they rely on. So if you prioritize making a connection first, potentially with your top 10 media contacts, and then once you've built up that connection, starting to send those pitches through, that might be an idea.
Absolutely. And I think we've got the luxury of, you know, being able to track them down on social media these days. And so prior to sending that story, you know, go and have a look at their Twitter, go and have a look at their Instagram.
I see you in your bedroom watching Netflix.
Hello.
Too much
Google last year. Exactly.
I've got the coordinates of the Vogue editor. You
know, okay. Do a mini vlog. I know which coffee shop she visits every Monday morning. Yeah. But go and do a little bit of stalking and have a look at what their interests are. A lot of them have Twitter accounts, and you can see they've reposted a lot of their stories, or they retweet things that they really like. Get an understanding of who they are, jump onto their Instagram, see what their passions are, and then sort of try and connect that way. So you're not just
sending... And then catfish them. No, just joking.
Yeah, pretty much. But, I mean, you know, you want to, just like a potential date, like if you meet someone online, you want to Google them and you want to see what their interests are. You want to see who their friends are. You want to see if they've got a dog or a cat, what sort of kind of interests you might have, right? I mean, I've been out of the dating world for a while, assume that's what most people would do.
No, I don't think that, I can only assume that that is not what we do. Although maybe it is, because both of you and I met our
husbands. That's it. We've been attached for so long. And in the analog, I would totally assume you would do a social stalk. So make sure before you do all your pitches and so forth, find out who you want to pitch to, do a bit of social stalk, find out their interests, find out whether they're going to like you and so forth. You might want to follow them. You might want to like a couple of their posts. You might want to respond to a couple of things. But make sure, hopefully you have that sort of gauge whether you're being stalkerish or not, because you definitely don't want to be annoying. But if you've already made a couple of connections with them on social or liked a couple of their things and done a bit of a research, I feel like with, you know, I think 4 or 5 touch points, you sort of start, you know, getting a bit more familiar with that editor.
You do. And I mean, one could argue, if we were to take an existential perspective, that you're manifesting that contact because you're bringing that energy in, you know, whichever way you want to look at it. It seems like focusing on the relationship and then making sure that once you've started to build that relationship, you'll intrinsically know how to pitch an idea in, because again, in my sort of PR experience and in yours, you do want to tailor your stories and your pitch and your angle to each publication, because they're not all the same. So if you know who you're talking to, then you kind of know, do you know what? I know this person actually really, these are some of the values that drive their writing, or
exactly,
I know this publication's audience are really more focused on the dollar saved, you know. So
that's exactly. And if you sort of, you do the same for your client, right? If you had styling clients, you do the same. You act a certain way, or you'll select particular brands because of that particular client. You'll select certain styles because you know that client, you know, it seems to like that kind of look a bit more. So just as you would a client, tailor clothing, and your services to them, you're just pretty much doing the same with editors and journalists and so forth that you're bitching to.
Beck, this has been so great. Thank you so much for sharing these insights. And I want to say the stuff that you have shared with us, it works, because that has been the backbone of your success time and time again. Had you just completely outsourced all of your PR, you know, for the last 15, 20 years, I wouldn't be asking your opinion. But you've actually done this yourself. And that hustle and that strategy of just playing it really, really smart has paid dividends. So I'm hoping that everyone listening tries out a few of these ideas. Thank you again, my love, for your time.
Such a pleasure. It's always great to chat to you.
Bye, my love.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Styling Advisory Podcast with Sarah Cohen. If you're enjoying the vibe, you can join our community of styling experts at The Styling Advisory on Instagram and Facebook. And you can watch these interviews on our YouTube channel, Styling Advisory TV. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to our show so Sarah can spend more time on the mic.